Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post, read by Bill Head. This is being recorded on Wednesday, July 3rd, 2024. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Ukraine, AI begins ushering in Age of Killer Robots by Paul Moser and Adam Satariano. Five Killed in Blaze. Third Arsonist Gets 60 Years by Laura Pennington. Reformulated Fuel, Despite Warnings, Gas Prices Remain Stable in Metro Denver by Noel Phillips. And Hush Money, Judge Delays Sentencing in Trump's New York Case by Jake Offenhartz and Jennifer Peltz. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Ukraine, AI begins ushering in an age of killer robots by Paul Moser and Adam Satariano, the New York Times. Kiev, Ukraine. In a field on the outskirts of Kiev, the founders of Vyriv, a Ukrainian drone company, were recently at work on a weapon of the future. To demonstrate it, Alexei Babenko, 25, Vyriv's CEO, hopped on his motorcycle and rode down a dirt path. Behind him, a drone followed as a colleague tracked the movements from the briefcase-size computer. Until recently, a human would have piloted the quadcopter, no longer. Instead, after the drone locked on its target, Babenko, it flew itself, guided by software that used the machine's camera to track him. The motorcycle's growling engine was no match for the silent drone as it stalked Babenko. If the drone had been armed with explosives, and if his colleagues hadn't disengaged the autonomous tracking, Babenko would have been a goner. Vyriv is just one of many Ukrainian companies working on a major leap forward in the weaponization of consumer technology driven by the war with Russia. The pressure to outthink the enemy, along with huge flows of investment, donations of government contracts, and government contracts, has turned Ukraine into a Silicon Valley for autonomous drones and other weaponry. What the companies are creating is technology that makes human judgment about targeting and firing increasingly tangential. The widespread availability of off-the-shelf devices, easy-to-design software, powerful automation algorithms, and specialized artificial intelligence microchips has pushed a deadly innovation race into uncharted territory, fueling a potential new era of killer robots. The most advanced versions of the technology that allows drones and other machines to act autonomously have been possible by deep learning, a form of AI that uses large amounts of data to identify patterns and make decisions. Deep learning has helped generate popular large language models like OpenAI's GPT-4, but it also helps make models interpret and respond in real time to video and camera footage. That means software that once helped a drone follow a snowboarder down a mountain can now become a deadly tool. In more than a dozen interviews with Ukrainian entrepreneurs, engineers, and military units, a picture emerged of a near future when swarms of self-guided drones can coordinate attacks and machine guns with computer vision can automatically shoot down soldiers. More outlandish creations like a hovering unmanned copter that wields machine guns are also being developed. While these weapons aren't as advanced as expensive military-grade systems made in the United States, China, and Russia, what makes the development significant is their low cost, just thousands of dollars or less, and ready availability. Except for the musicians, many of these weapons are built with code found online and components that can be bought from Best Buy and a hardware store. Some U.S. officials said they worried about the abilities could soon be used to carry out terrorist attacks. For Ukraine, the technologies could provide an edge against Russia, which is also developing autonomous killer gadgets, or simply help to keep pace. The systems raise the stakes in an international debate about the ethical and legal ramifications of AI on the battlefield. Human rights groups and United Nations officials want to limit the use of autonomous weapons for fear that they may trigger a new global arms race that could spiral out of control. In Ukraine, such concerns are secondary to fighting off an invader. We need maximum automation, said Mikhailo Fedorov, Ukraine's Minister of Digital Transformation, who has led the country's efforts to use tech startups to expand advanced fighting capabilities. These technologies are fundamental to our victory. Autonomous drones like Vairis have already been used in combat to hit Russian targets, according to Ukrainian officials and video verified by the New York Times. Fedorov said the government was working to fund drone companies to help them rapidly scale up production. In a ramshackle workshop in an apartment building in eastern Ukraine, Dev, a 28-year-old soldier in the 92nd Assault Brigade, has helped push innovations that turn cheap drones into weapons. First, he strapped bombs to racing drones and then added larger batteries to help them fly farther, and recently incorporated night vision so the machines can hunt in the dark. In May, he was one of the first to use autonomous drones, including those from Bayeri. While some required improvements, Dev said, he believed that they would be the next big technological jump to hit the front lines. Autonomous drones are already in demand, he said. The machines have been especially helpful against jamming that can break communication links between drone and pilot. With the drone flying itself, a pilot can simply lock into a target and let the device do the rest. Makeshift factories and labs have sprung up across Ukraine to build remote-controlled machines of all sizes, from long-range aircraft and attack boats to cheap kamikaze drones, abbreviated as FPVs for first-person view, because they are guided by a pilot wearing virtual reality-like goggles that give a view from the drone. Many are precursors to machines that will eventually act on their own. Efforts to automate FPV flights began last year, but were slowed by setbacks building flight control software, according to Fedorov, who said those problems have been resolved. The next step was to scale the technology with more government spending, he said, adding that about 10 companies were already making autonomous drones. We already have systems which can be mass-produced, and they're now extensively tested on the front lines, which means they're already actively used, Fedorov said. On a hot afternoon last month in eastern Ukrainian region known as the Donbas, Yuri Klontasek, a 23-year-old reservist, trained four soldiers to use the latest futuristic weapon, a gun turret with autonomous targeting that works with a PlayStation controller and a tablet. Speaking over booms of nearby shelling, Klonstack explained how the gun, called Wall-E after resemblance to the Pixar robot Wall-E, can auto-lock on a target up to 1,000 meters away and jump between pre-programmed positions to quickly cover a broad area. The company making the weapon, DevDroid, was also developing an auto-aim to track and hit moving targets. When I first saw the gun, I was fascinated, Klonczak said. I understood this was the only way, if not to win this war, then to at least hold our positions. The gun is one of several that have emerged on the front lines using AI-trained software to automatically track and shoot targets. Not dissimilar to the object identification featured in surveillance cameras, software on screen surrounds humans and other would-be targets with a digital box. All that's left for the shooter to do is remotely pull the trigger with a video game controller. Often battlefield demands pull together engineers and soldiers. Alexander Yabchanka, a commander in Da Vinci Wolves, a battalion known for its innovation in weaponry, recalled how the need to defend the road of life, a route used to supply troops fighting Russians along the eastern front line in Bakhmut, had spurred invention. Imagining a solution, he posted an open request on Facebook for a computerized remote control machine gun. In several months, Yabchanka had a working prototype from a firm called Raboneers. The gun was almost instantly helpful for his unit. "We could sit in the trench drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes and shoot at the Russians," he said. Five killed in blaze. DUI Dewey pleaded guilty to second-degree murder for role in starting fire in Green Valley Ranch by Laura Pennington. More than a dozen members of Colorado's Senegalese community listened in silence inside a Denver courtroom Tuesday morning, waiting for their final chance to be heard as nearly 4 years of police investigation and court proceedings finally came to a close. They bowed their heads, closed their eyes, and gripped each other's hands as the final arsonist responsible for a horrific Green Valley Ranch house fire that killed five people faced sentencing. A handful more who tuned in from Western Africa sat in a digital waiting room or on a speakerphone. Kevin Bowie, "This is all I have left," of Jabril, family friend Lamine Kane said, holding up a pair of white and blue sneakers at the podium. "You destroyed a whole community. Did you know right from wrong that night when you bought the masks, when you planned the trip?" After 1,427 days, Kevin Bowie, the last of three teen arsonists who soaked the inside of a Truckee Street home with gas and ignited the blaze that killed three Senegalese adults and two children, was sentenced to 60 years in prison by Denver District Court Judge Karen Brody. The sentencing of Kevin Bowie marks the end of the darkest chapters in one of the darkest chapters in Denver's history. Deputy District Attorney Courtney Johnston said during the hearing, "This was no accident. This was not impulsive. It was not careless. It was not reckless. It was by design. It was the goal to burn the house down and kill everyone in it." Johnston said it was fitting to end the legal chapter of this case with Bowie's sentencing, given that his plan caused it all to happen in the early morning hours of August 5th, 2020. Djibril Diol, 29, his wife Aja Diol, 23, and their daughter Khadija Diol, 1, died in the house fire along with Djibril's sister Hassan Diol, 25, and her six-month-old daughter Hawa Bayi. Bowie, now 20, and two other then-teens, Gavin Seymour and Dylan Siebert, planned the fire for weeks. They set the house ablaze because Bowie mistakenly believed someone who had stolen his phone lived there and he wanted revenge, according to court testimony. A security camera captured a ghostly image of the three teens wearing masks and hoodies near the site of the fire. "As homicide detectives, we see death every day and usually learn to live with it," said Neil Baker, a Denver police detective. "This is one of the cases in my 33 years of law enforcement that I'll take with me forever. This is by far one of the most senseless murders we've ever investigated." Kane, a friend of the Dioles for more than a decade, said he's been acting as an interpreter throughout the court cases, talking for the family and filling them in on the courtroom details. He said the years of hearings have not allowed members of the Senegalese community to mourn, forcing them to revolve their lives around the courtroom. "I'll never get it out of my mind how Jabril's mom hugged me and just screamed, he said, remembering his visit to Diol's Senegal home after the family's death. Speaking through Kane over the phone from Senegal, Jabril and Hassan's father, Hanaday Diol, said the fire still feels like yesterday, even as the fourth anniversary approaches. Since this has happened, I am a dead person that isn't buried yet, Hanaday Diol told the court. Bui pleaded guilty to two counts of second-degree murder in March, a plea agreement that saw prosecutors drop 60 other charges, including multiple counts of first-degree murder, assault, burglary, and arson. The agreement also dismissed a second, separate case in which the then 18-year-old was accused of bringing drugs into jail. Brody sentenced Bui to 30 years in prison and a mandatory 5-year parole for each count of second-degree murder during Tuesday's hearing, a length the defense and prosecution agreed on and stipulated in the plea agreement. The 20-year-old could have faced as many as 48 years in prison on each count. This is an incomprehensible and senseless tragedy, Brody said. The loss of innocent lives is horrific. Although his parents sat on the hard benches of the Denver courthouse when Bui pleaded guilty in March, the duo watched the sentencing hearing online Tuesday, listening with the help of Vietnamese interpreter. I imagine that I would say so many times, but I still can't piece together any words that fully describe the pain, Bui said in a statement to the court. No matter what I do, no matter how much time it takes for lives to resume or for the media to forget these people, the scars will still be there. Bui took full responsibility for the arson and deaths Tuesday. It is not Dylan's fault and it's not Gavin's fault, he said to the court. Regardless of who did what, I take full responsibility. At the end of the day, my words and actions don't take the pain away. Alongside Baker, 10 members of the Colorado Senegalese community gave statements to the court for the prosecution, asking Brody to ignore the plea deal and deliver maximum sentence. I will never forget or forgive you what you did to me, said Amandu Bay, whose one-year-old daughter died in the flames. Brody had asked Bay multiple times to look at her and away from Bui when delivering his statement. I don't know if I'm going to be able to say what I need to say without looking at him, Bay said during turning back to Bui. You killed 5 people, took me away from my wife, and took me away from a baby that will never have a chance to see again. If I were you, I would kill myself. Wearing a t-shirt reading #JusticeForDiolFamily, Osman Ba, another family friend, also took the stand. I will never call my best friend again, he said. I will never be able to stay up late just talking about life goals, life plans, and the thing that hurts the most for me is I can't stop thinking about it. Ba said, Djibril Diol asked him years ago if Denver was the right place, and that Ba, who had lived in Denver since he was 6 years old, told him to come. After that horrific day, I didn't know if this was my home anymore, Ba said. Our community was hurt, and I lost the trust I had in the city. In March, Brody sentenced 19-year-old Seymour to 40 years in prison after he pleaded guilty to second-degree murder, the maximum possible sentence he faced. Seibert was 14 at the time of the crime and prosecuted as a juvenile. He pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in 2022 and was sentenced to 3 years in juvenile detention, followed by 7 years in prison. The case against Bui and Seymour stalled for several months after the pair challenged the legality of the search warrant Denver police used to identify them through Google search results as suspects in the fire. The Colorado Supreme Court upheld the search warrant in October. Reformulated fuel. Despite warnings, gas prices remain stable in Metro Denver. Polis Oil and Gas Industry had warned prices could rise by as much as 60 cents per gallon by Noel Phillips. The threat that a specialized blend of gasoline would send gas prices in Metro Denver and the Northern Front Range skyrocketing fizzled faster than a July 4th sparkler. Gas prices in the region have remained steady in the month since motorists started using reformulated gasoline a special blend that produces less ozone pollution. The Environmental Protection Agency mandated the region's gas stations sell the blend from June to September, the hot months when ozone pollution is thickest, after declaring Colorado was in severe violation of federal air quality standards. When the new requirement went into effect on June 1, Governor Jared Polis and representatives from the oil and gas industry warned gas prices could increase by as much as 60 cents per gallon, which would have pushed the cost of a gallon above $4 for the first time since 2022. Meanwhile, the EPA estimated the price of gasoline would go up by 3 to 5 cents per gallon. The EPA's prediction has proved to be more in line with what drivers have paid at the pump. As of Tuesday, the average cost of a gallon of gas in Colorado is $3.37, up 3 cents since June 2nd, but down 38 cents from the same time last year. Gas prices jumped 6 cents a gallon overnight Tuesday in anticipation of the July 4th holiday as families hit the road for vacations and family gatherings. Skyler McKinley, a spokesman for AAA Colorado, said he was monitoring gas prices daily since the reformulated requirement began, and AAA has studied the impacts of reformulated gas in other parts of the country. I was surprised from the vantage point there were so many stories of doom and gloom from reformulated gas, McKinley said. The doom and gloom scenario was never in the cards. The second Suncor decided they were going to make production here. Suncor Energy said it spent $45 million at its Commerce City refinery to make and store the special blend locally. Suncor supplies 35 to 40% of the gas sold in Colorado, so there is a ready supply that doesn't have to be imported from other states. McKinley said the concerns about gas prices reaching nearly $4 per gallon were worst-case scenarios that would have been caused by supply chain shortages and other disruptions. But those scenarios have not developed. Earlier this year, Polis and U.S. Rep. Yadira Caraveo, Democrat from Adams County, lobbied the Biden administration to grant a waiver so that Colorado would not have to sell reformulated gas. The EPA, however, said it has no choice but to enforce the clean air requirement on the state, but its leaders kept the waiver request open in case of a gas shortage due to unforeseen circumstances later in the year. Ali Sullivan, a spokeswoman for the governor, said Polis continues to advocate for a federal waiver just in case gas prices spike this summer. In the days after the reformulated gas went into effect, prices in Colorado jumped an average of 15 cents per gallon, but have since stabilized, McKinley said. On Monday, 1 month after the reformulated gasoline went on sale, the average cost of a gallon of gas had actually dropped across Metro Denver and the Northern Front Range. Gas also is about 40 cents per gallon cheaper now than it was at the same time in 2023. Here's a look at the average prices for a gallon of gas Tuesday, according to AAA Colorado. National, $3.50. Colorado, $3.37, up 3 cents since June 2nd, and down 38 cents since July 2nd, 2023. Boulder, $3.34, up 1 cent since June 2nd, and down 40 cents since July 2nd, 2023. Denver, $3.36, up 4 cents since June 2nd and down 39 cents since July 2nd, 2023. Fort Collins, $3.33, up 1 cent since June 2nd and down 41 cents since July 2nd, 2023. Greeley, $3.31, up 7 cents since June 2nd and down 41 cents since July 2nd, 2023. Gasoline prices always are volatile because they are impacted by events often out of the control of gas station owners, refineries, and politicians. The most immediate threat to gas prices is Hurricane Beryl, which made landfall Monday on the Caribbean island of Cariacao and started barreling towards Jamaica on Tuesday after becoming the earliest Cat 5 storm on record in the Atlantic, fueled by record warm waters. Its projected path would send send it through Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, according to the Associated Press. Depending on where it lands, could wall up refining capacity nationwide, McKinley said of the possibility the storm could veer towards the Gulf of Mexico, where the nation gets much of its oil. Barrel's arrival early in the season and its strength also raised concerns that the 2024 hurricane season would be a bad one, and that could impact U.S. gas prices, McKinley said. Ongoing conflict in the Middle East and Ukraine also causes gas prices to fluctuate, so does OPEC production. Part of the debate in Colorado involved just how much of the region's air quality would benefit from reformulated gas and whether the pollution reduction would be worth the extra cost to consumers. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment reported that Suncor's volatile organic compound emissions increased 0.81 tons in the past year as it prepared to make the fuel. Volatile organic compounds react with nitrogen oxides and hot summer days to create ground-level ozone pollution, which causes brown smog to hang in the air and is dangerous to people with breathing problems such as asthma. The EPA estimated that 210 tons of volatile organic compounds and 50 tons of nitrogen oxides would be eliminated by using reformulated gasoline in Colorado over the summer. Richard Milot, an APA spokesman, said producers and suppliers were prepared for the requirement in Colorado and prices reflect that preparation. As is normally the case, variability in gasoline prices over the rest of the summer months will be related to driving consumer demand around busy holidays, global, national, or regional events affecting crude oil or refining capacity, and other factors that can impact prices at the pump, Milot wrote in an email. Hush Money, Judge Delays Sentencing in Trump's New York Case, by Jake Offenhartz and Jennifer Peltz, the Associated Press. In a major reprieve for former President Donald Trump, sentencing for his hush money convictions was postponed Tuesday until at least September, if ever, as the judge agreed to weigh the possible impact of a new Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity. Trump had been scheduled to face sentencing July 11th, just before the Republicans' nominating convention on his New York convictions on felony charges of falsifying business records. He denies any wrongdoing. The postponement sets the sentencing for September 18th at the earliest, if it happens at all, since Trump's lawyers are arguing that the Supreme Court ruling merits not only delaying the sentencing, but tossing out his conviction. The impact of the immunity ruling is a loud and clear signal for justice in the United States, Trump crowed on his Truth social media site after the sentencing was delayed. Using all capital letters, he claimed the Supreme Court's decision netted him total exoneration in this and other criminal cases he faces. There was no immediate comment on the sentencing postponement from Manhattan prosecutors who brought the hush money case. Though the September 18th date is well after this month's Republican National Convention, where Trump is set formally to accept the party's nomination for president in this year's race, it is far closer to Election Day, which could put the issue top of the mind for voters just as they seriously tune into the race. Because of absentee voting timelines in certain states, some voters may have already cast ballots before anyone knows whether the former president will have to spend time in jail or on home confinement. The delay caps a string of political and legal wins for Trump in recent days, including the Supreme Court's immunity ruling and a debate widely seen as a disaster for Democratic President Joe Biden. The immunity decision all but closed the door on the possibility that Trump could face a trial in 2020 election interference case in Washington before this November's vote. The timeline in itself is a victory for the former president, who has sought to delay his four criminal cases past the balloting. An appeals court recently paused a separate election interference case against Trump in Georgia. No trial date has been set. His federal classified documents case in Florida remains bogged down by pre-trial disputes that have resulted in an indefinite cancellation of the trial date. Monday's Supreme Court ruling granted broad immunity protections to presidents while also restricting prosecutors from citing any official acts as evidence in trying to prove a president's unofficial actions violated the law. The High Court held that former presidents are absolutely immune from prosecution for actions that fall within their core constitutional duties, such as interacting with the Justice Department, and at least presumptively immune for all other official acts. The justices left intact the long-standing principle that no immunity exists for purely personal acts. It is not clear how the decision will affect the New York hush money case. Its underpinnings involved allegations that pre-presidency Trump participated in a scheme to stifle sex stories that he feared would be damaging to his 2016 campaign. But the actual charges had to do with payments made in 2017 to his then lawyer, Michael Cohen, who had shelled out hush money on Trump's behalf. Trump was present when he signed relevant checks to Cohen. Trump's lawyers sought unsuccessfully before the trial to keep out certain evidence that they said concerned official acts, including social media posts he made as president. They may face a similar uphill climb in trying to argue now that the Supreme Court ruling warrants tossing out the New York conviction. When Trump vied unsuccessfully last year to get the hush money case moved from state court to federal court, U.S. District Judge Alvin Hellerstein rejected the former president's claim that allegations in the hush money indictment involved official duties. The evidence overwhelmingly suggests that the matter was purely personal item of the president, a cover-up of an embarrassing event, Hellerstein wrote last year. Hours after Monday's Supreme Court ruling, Trump's attorneys requested that New York Judge Juan Merchan set aside the jury's guilty verdict and delay the sentencing to consider how the high court's ruling could affect the hush money case. Merchan wrote that he'll rule September 6th, and the next date in the case would be September 18th, if such is still necessary. In the defense filing Monday, Trump's attorneys argued that Manhattan prosecutors had placed highly prejudicial emphasis on official acts evidence, including Trump's social media posts and witness testimony from the Oval Office meetings. Prosecutors responded that they believed those arguments were without merit, that they wouldn't oppose adjourning the sentencing for 2 weeks as the judge considers the matter. Trump was convicted on May 30th of 34 counts of falsifying business records arising from what prosecutors said was an attempt to cover up $130,000 hush money payment to porn actor Stormy Daniels just before the 2016 presidential election. Daniels claimed she had a sexual encounter with Trump in 2006 after meeting him at a celebrity golf tournament in Lake Tahoe. Trump has repeatedly denied the claim, saying at Thursday's debate with Biden, "I didn't have sex with a porn star." Prosecutors said the Daniels payment was part of a broader scheme to buy the silence of people who might have gone public during the campaign with embarrassing stories allegedly Trump had extramarital sex. Trump said they all were false. Cohen paid Daniels and was later reimbursed by Trump, whose company logged the reimbursements as legal expenses. Trump's defense argued that the payments were indeed for legal work and were so correctly categorized. Falsifying business records is punishable by up to 4 years behind bars. Other potential sentences include probation, a fine, or a conditional discharge, which would require Trump to stay out of trouble to avoid additional punishment. Trump is the first ex-president convicted of a crime. Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Richard Brin, October 6, 1947 to June 23, 2024. Richard was in the Coast Guard and was a manager for telecom. There were no services planned at this time. Beverly Jean Conklin, July 31, 1931 to June 24, 2024. Beverly Jean Conklin was born in South Denver to Margaret and Orville Nash on July 31st, 1931. Louine A. Vaughn, February 2nd, 1942 to April 20th, 2024. Louine Carol Anderson Vaughn, age 82, of Centennial, Colorado, passed away peacefully on April 20th, 2024. Earl Sherwood Wilder, July 7th, 1931 to June 10th, 2024. Earl was born July 7, 1931 in Kansas City, Missouri, but grew up in Chicago, a city he loved, along with all things Lincoln. Now I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. Election 2024, pressure from Democrats builds for Biden to step aside, by Steve Peoples, Will Weissert, and Joey Cappelletti, the Associated Press, Washington. Bernie Sanders describes President Joe Biden's recent debate performance as painful. In an interview, he says he's not confident that Biden can win this fall. But the progressive senator from Vermont does not want Biden to step aside. Instead, Sanders, who served as Biden's chief rival for the Democratic Party's 2020 nomination fight, is calling on voters to adopt a maturity as they view their options this fall. A presidential election is not a Grammy Award contest for the best singer or entertainer. It's about who has the best policies that impact our lives, Sanders said. I'm going to do everything I can to see that Biden gets reelected. That's putting the best face on it. Nearly a week after Biden's disastrous debate performance, questions about his ability to remain in the race are intensifying among concerned Democrats. But there is also a growing sense that the party has trapped itself in a bad situation with no clear solution, caught in a primary process set up to protect Biden with elected officials unwilling to say out loud what they some say quietly. Some allies, like Sanders, are acknowledging Biden's problems but contrasting his policies and records with those of the Republican Donald Trump. But many donors, strategists, and party insiders want Biden to suspend his re-election campaign to avoid what they see as a certain defeat come November. Representative Lloyd Doggett of Texas on Tuesday became the first House Democrat to call for the president to withdraw, saying too much is at stake for Biden to stay in the race and lose to Trump. He has the opportunity to encourage a new generation of leaders from whom a nominee can be chosen, to unite our country through an open democratic process, Doggett said in a written statement. My decision to make these strong reservations public is not done lightly, nor does it in any way diminish my respect for that all that President Biden has achieved. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told MSNBC that she believes it is a legitimate question whether Biden's halting performance is just an episode or is this a condition. When people ask that question, it's legitimate of both candidates, Pelosi said. Pelosi said that she had not spoken with Biden since the debate, but said that she emphasized that the president is on top of his game in terms of knowing the issues and what is at stake. In private, people close to would-be Biden replacements, including California Governor Gavin Newsom, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and Vice President Kamala Harris, are having informal conversations about potential next steps should Biden abruptly change course and step aside. Such conversations include talk of potential running mates, according to donors involved in the discussions. Names of potential vice presidential nominees that have surfaced, including Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear and California Rep. Ro Khanna. Every one of the officials on such lists has publicly pledged support for Biden in recent days. And ever-defiant, Biden's team has downplayed the president's political problems in a series of memos and private meetings with donors, strategists, and party insiders. The voters are powerless, said Nina Turner, a national co-chair of Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign, who now fears the Democratic Party cannot win again with Biden as the nominee. The decision rests solely with him. Amid such frustration, key groups in Biden's political coalition who had signs of fraying even before the debate, have begun to turn against each other. The business of booze. Law's Whiskey House new taproom was almost ready to serve cocktails by Tiny Ricciardi. As a whiskey maker, Al Laws is no stranger to waiting. Laws, president and founder of Laws Whiskey House in Denver, distilled his first batch of liquor on July 4, 2011. But because time is an essential ingredient in whiskey, it wasn't until October 2014 that he released the first bottles. That said, it's been more than 6 years since he began the journey to renovate the distillery's taproom. Both he and local drinkers may soon see the project get to the finish line. Laws Whiskey House anticipates debuting its new taproom at 1420 South Acoma Street to the thirsty public in late August or early September. When it does, the space will be significantly bigger, about 4,000 square feet compared to the previous 300 square feet, Laws said, and include a bar shaking up cocktails with house spirits and mezzanine seating. The distillery has long had what it calls a whiskey church, an area outfitted with pews like where folks go to learn about and pay homage to whiskey, Laws said. The new taproom design leans into the ethos with a new two-story Gothic window that lends an elegant feel to the space, he added. It's a great place, but it's not going to be open until 2 a.m. It's a place you come for pre-dinner drinks, or you have a date, or you have a friend in town, or you have a quick business thing, Law said. The bar will serve only house-made spirits, but that doesn't mean the menu is limited to whiskey. Over the years, Law's Whiskey House has no doubt honed its namesake spirit using only Colorado-grown grains. But the distillery has also made other liquors like vermouth, rum, and agave that it plans to integrate into the bar program. To that end, there will be certain spirits that drinkers can only find in the tap room alongside longtime staples like four-grain bourbon cask strength, which was recently named the best small batch bourbon made outside of Kentucky at the World Whiskies Award. Part of the expansion includes revamping the Laws Whiskey House tour and eventually adding a rooftop deck where drinkers can take in vistas of the mountains in Mile High City. But first, Laws simply wants to open. As the distillery's 13th anniversary approaches, he feels cautiously optimistic about the project coming to fruition. The fact we're so close, it's a weird kind of hum in your head. Like, are we really? What's going to keep us from opening? That's the way we think about it now, he said. You can just feel joy about it until it's done. Branching out, Rosenberg starts Slider pop-up in Five Points by Lily O'Neill. Since the pandemic, Joshua Pollack's New York-inspired restaurant group has really changed how we think about growth, he said. After he closed Rosenberg's Bagels in Boulder in October 2020, a little over a year after opening, Pollack was hesitant to take another risk. At some point, we'll open more Rosenbergs, pizza places, and maybe even another Lou's, Pollack said. But for now, we really want to bring forth food we enjoy and share without the rigmarole of opening a restaurant. We wanted to use Rosenberg's at night to try out some pop-up things we've been thinking about for a long time. Starting this month until Labor Day, Rosenberg's Bagels at 725 East 26th Avenue in Five Points is hosting a late-night slider pop-up dubbed Rosenberg's from 5 p.m. to 2 a.m. It made the most sense to activate our space in a neighborhood we already have such a relationship with, Pollack said. All of Pollack's Bridge and Tunnel restaurants, including famous Original J's Pizza and Lou's Italian Specialties, pay homage to his upbringing in Jersey and New York. And Rosenberg's is no exception. The pop-up is modeled after White Manna, an old-school burger institution that started at the World's Fair in 1939. And moved to Hackensack, New Jersey in 1946. In this gem of nostalgia and Americana from the early 1900s, Pollack said. I grew up going there, and these were the original fast food burgers. It's a small little hut with a flat top in the center, and you always leave smelling of onions and burgers. Like White Manna, Rosenburgers will serve simple sliders with cheese, pickles, ketchup, mustard, and an in-house special sauce and white onions that are smashed into the beef patty. The beef, which will be sourced from local producers, is ground fresh daily, and Pollock worked hard with his provider to secure specific Martin's potato slider buns. We work hard to keep all the details as exact as possible, just like with our New York water at Rosenberg's, he said, referring to the special water filtration system that Rosenberg's used to mimic water levels in New York for its authentic bagels. One slider goes for $3.80 or a double for $6.70, and a party sack, $50, comes with 10 sliders and 4 orders of fries. The pop-up, which delivers, also offers simple shakes, malts, and pastries. I can usually eat between 3 and 4, but I've been working the last 2 weekends there. As we've been testing it out, so I'll start eating at 5 p.m., and by 1 in the morning, I've had like 6 of these things, Pollock said. Pollock has seen a new energy in 5 Points since the summer kicked off, especially with concerts at Cervantes every weekend and the late-night traffic from the Marigold and 715 Club nearby. When I moved here, there were no good bagels, pizzas, or hoagies, so that's where all my ideas came from, but there was also no late-night food, Pollock said. Famous Original J's Pizza next door is open until 2 a.m., and we've seen such success there. With the amount of vacancies on the Welton Street corridor, we're excited to champion the nightlife there. The more active you can make it, the more traffic and less crime there will be. If Rosenberger's really has legs, Pollock said, he will consider keeping it in the Rosenberg space or find its own brick and mortar for a year-round service. But he does have plans to test out other pop-ups like a taco concept model after Los Tacos No. 1 in New York City and high-end deli food. In brief, Denver saw its second hottest June on record. After a month of above normal temperatures and 90-degree weather, June 2024 is officially the second hottest June on record for the Denver area, according to the National Weather Service. On average, Denver temperatures in June hover around 68 degrees, according to NWS records. This year, June's average temperature was 73.8 degrees, 1.2 degrees below the all-time high record of 75 degrees set in 2012, NWS forecasters said. The monthly average temperature combines the daytime highs and overnight lows. More than half of the days in June 2024 saw temperature highs in the 90s for the metro area, and Denver reached 100 degrees for the first time since August 2022. While the Denver area didn't break record for the hottest June, NWS forecasters said other areas like Boulder were setting their own records. Just last year, we set the record for the wettest May-June period ever recorded in Denver, NWS meteorologists said Monday. This year, it's the driest May-June ever in Boulder. Denver didn't see its driest June ever, but the city still fell short of the expected rainfall by nearly 2 inches of rain, according to NWS meteorologists. Northern Colorado and Eastern Plains saw similar rain shortages, with precipitation totals coming in around half or less than half of the May-June average. Laura Pennington, the Denver Post. Two hikers rescued after attempting four-pass loop. Mountain Rescue Aspen rescued two hikers that were stranded after attempting to complete the four-pass loop. The Pitkin County Regional Emergency Dispatch Center was alerted at about 9:27 p.m. Sunday that two hikers had attempted to complete the 25.7-mile trail were stranded near Snowmass Lake. The hikers had lost their gear, had no shelter, and were cold and wet. Dispatch was alerted of a Garmin InReach SOS activation in the Maroon Bells Snowmass Wilderness Area. The Mountain Rescue Aspen was contacted about 9:48 p.m., and a team of four rescuers went into the field on foot at about 11:20 p.m. Sunday. A helicopter rescue mission was not possible due to hazardous weather conditions. Rescuers found the two hikers at about 5:04 a.m. Monday and were able to escort them down the Snowmass Creek Trail. The hikers were uninjured and reached the trailhead at about 10:17 a.m. Monday. The four-pass loop is a challenging 25.7-mile trail near Aspen that gets its name from the four 12,000-foot passes it traverses, Aspen Times. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post, read by Bill Head.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.